And I think after that experience and after, you know, what she did for me, I've made it my life goal to, you know, make, if I can make life better for any and every horse that comes, you know, crosses my path, in even the smallest ways, then I'm going to do that. So, you know, I'm going to stand up for them. I'm going to give them a voice, and I'm going to try and share with people and other professionals, you know, that perspective, and hope that big picture, just, they just benefit from it and have a better life.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. And we're back. Tracy here with a new episode of Hitting Your Stride, which I'm really excited to bring to you. Today, I have Claire Hunter joining me on the podcast. She's the owner, operator, breeder, and trainer at Braycrest Farm, north of Barrie, Ontario. And she brings a very unique perspective to working with horses that I cannot wait to share with you. This episode has a lot of great stuff, as Claire and I talk about how she has made her little girl dream come true in having a career working with horses, but also how with all the things that she does, that to her, it doesn't feel like work at all. We talk about her intuition when it comes to horses and how she relentlessly advocates for every equine companion she has on her farm every chance she gets. Claire's desire for knowing all that she can about horses speaks to her level of commitment to each one she has on her farm. Be prepared to cry a little as we talk about the joys and the tragedies of being a breeder, and then be ready to be amazed as Claire describes the need for horses to just be themselves. Like I said, this is one of those episodes that I couldn't wait to share with all of you because I think you're going to get as much out of it as I did. As Claire is about to tell you, celebrate as you go because it's all about the journey. And on that note, let's hit our stride. Hey, Claire, welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for the invite. I'm really excited to be a part of it. And I know we've been trying to do this for a little while, but, you know, horse people. So
that's right. Good things come to those who wait. So this is worked out finally. This is awesome. Yeah. So why don't you start us off? Why don't you tell us about how your passion for horses developed over the years? Was it something you always knew you wanted to do when you were young, or did it grow out of a specific event in your life?
Well, it's, you know, I come from just a regular family. I actually grew up in Etobicoke, and I went to horse camp when I was 8. And I only went because a friend of mine went, and I was jealous and wanted to go, and I was hooked. That was it. So, you know, was able to enroll in weekly lessons and then part boarding and the whole process, and asked for a horse every day of my life. And when I was 15, I was lucky enough that my parents bought me my first horse, who was just a horse, but she was my horse, and it was so exciting and the beginning of really great things. So, you know, and when I was a teenager and going through school, I never thought you could be a horse professional. It never crossed my mind as something that I could do as a business long term. I was going to be either a math teacher or I think a marine biologist, or I think veterinarian was also on my list because I had a background in working in a small animal clinic and was always interested in that stuff. So basically when I turned 18, there's a lot of things that happened in my teens that kind of set me on this trajectory, but I, I got a job riding professionally, riding racehorses, exercising and breaking babies, and riding field hunters. So this kind of opened my eyes to actually, you know, a job to be paid to ride horses. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. I've always paid to ride horses, and now they're, you know, looking for my skill set. And it was the first time that I'd been really introduced to breaking and starting young horses. And we broke like 25 thoroughbreds each fall. And basically day one, tack on. Day two, they're being ponied down the driveway. And day three, you're bellying them and sitting on them. Day four, you're like hacking down the road. So, I think six riders came and went in the couple of years that I was there, mostly because they got hurt. But I had a connection with the horses. I had a feel that I don't know, I was just blessed to have. I couldn't really put it in words. An intuition that kept me safe. And it just, I don't know, it was a great couple of years. So, from there, you know, as I say, I grew up in Etobicoke. When I was also 18, my parents and I moved out of the city and we bought our first farm, and it was near Loretto, near Alliston. And it was basically just to have my horse at home and maybe a couple others, never really plans, but we just wanted to move out of the city and start fresh. And after having this riding job and now having this facility, you know, I thought, maybe there's something here. And you know, did some market research and really found that there was a big need for people to be, you know, somebody to be starting, mostly young warm bloods, hunters, jumpers, that wasn't any kind of cowboy method, more traditional, gentler, kinder. I mean, some cowboy methods are gentle too, don't get me wrong, but just to develop these young horses a little differently. So I just, you know, put myself out there, and rest is history, I suppose. The first horse that came in, well, she's the one that's now 23, and things took off from there. So,
yeah. Wow. That's awesome. I love the fact you used the word intuition at one point in time. Your intuition kept you safe.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts we can get working with horses, is being able to communicate on that level with them. And for us humans, some of us have a bit more of that than others. So that's kind of cool that you didn't necessarily grow up with horses in your family, but you have something about you that intuitively connects with them and reads them. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I was talking to my mom, who's, a great supporter earlier, and she said, it must just be in your blood somehow, you know, a great grandparent or great, who knows. But, it was interesting. I was a nervous rider to start, and I always got very nervous when we had to switch school horses. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, I was the one that my coach was putting on the new horses and the difficult horses and, anything that was a little bit sensitive or quirky. And I didn't really know why. I mean, I was, 10, 11, 12, 13. And I just got along great with these horses. And so it's kind of grateful. I just had this kind of knack to work with and understand them and get through to them on a different level than a lot of people. So
I think that would be a really good age to get introduced to that stuff, because like you said, and I remember too, as a kid, and you get comfortable on one school horse and then somebody switches. And even like adults I talk to today, they're used to riding one horse. You get on a new one, it's a whole new beast, a whole new personality. So at that age, how did you deal with your nerves? Did you just kind of trust the fact that your coach said that, guess what, Claire, you can ride this horse, and just did it?
I think I wanted it so badly that I just, gritted my teeth and just did it. You know, nice. I did trust her. She was a fabulous coach and she had great horses. And I trusted her judgment, but it still took a good push for myself. But as I say, I just wanted it so badly that I thought, nope, that's my choice. I'm going to do it. I want to ride. I want to be here. I'm going to do it.
That's awesome. That is a great mindset for like not even a teenager to have, to recognize that you want it that badly. That's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So given where you are now with Braycrest Farm and how you're growing and everything, and one of the things that I found really interesting is that you call yourself a caregiver and an advocate for horses. How did you come to see yourself as an advocate? Where does that fit into the rest of what you do as a breeder and trainer?
I think because I feel like I've always understood them and I've always heard them on a different level than I think a lot of people, or in awareness, as I say, intuition. I think that is really, really key in understanding their mindset, what they need, what, you know, how they're feeling, and, you know, and then in turn, giving them a voice. You know, back to my childhood and my first horse, I actually lost my brother when I was 16 and, to a nasty health complication. And my horse saved my life. You know, she was there, she was my rock, she was my reason to get out of bed every day. And I think after that experience and after, you know, what she did for me, I've made it my life goal to, if I can make life better for any and every horse that comes, you know, crosses my path, in even the smallest ways, then I'm going to do that. So, you know, I'm going to stand up for them. I'm going to give them a voice, and I'm going to try and share with people and other professionals, that perspective, and hope that big picture, they benefit from it and have a better life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know as a massage therapist, I'm often for the horses, I'm often put in that exact same position. You sense something, you pick something up about them. Being an advocate requires that you really have to step up and have a voice and speak for them. How have you dealt with that? Like, have you, you know, because I'm sure with some owners that might be a touchy conversation.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's kind of a process too with confidence, you know. And this is actually our 20-year kind of anniversary of living on a farm and living this life. And in my 20s, when I was like, I started my business when I was 19, and most people that worked for me were older clients, and so there was always a little. I felt like I had to do a little bit of a dance. Most people didn't actually know how young I was, I guess, the way I presented myself or spoke or, communicated with people. But as I've gotten older, it's gotten easier, because I think a lot of people are influenced by, you know, what people think of them, or, you know, what they're supposed to be doing or what they're supposed to say, or all of that. It's just a real fact of life. But as you get older, you worry less about that stuff. So, you know, speaking up for the horses, for example, we've been doing 3-year-old cup horses to the Royal now for almost 20 years. And through that process, you know, I've learned a whole lot from the horses about the process, how they handle it internally, their immune system, their, you know, psychologically, stress levels, everything. So, you know, now I'm able to advise clients, you know, this personality type, I wouldn't recommend doing the under saddle. I would just do the model, because trying to prep them for the under saddle is quite an intense process, and they're babies, they're 3. So I feel like I can speak up a lot more now, and I'm confident in that. And I still respect people's choices, of course. But I feel like I can deliver, you know, from my experience, from the horses, speak up for them confidently, in any of their needs. And well, almost 100% of the time, it is so very well received. I think people are grateful for that insight and that experience. And then, you know, in turn, we're helping the horses have a better experience.
This is awesome. Fascinating. I love this.
Yeah, I mean, communication is so important. And, you know, people think, oh, you spend all day with the horses, but there's so many elements to what you do that you have to be good at communicating if you want to do what's best for the horses. So that's amazing.
Yeah. And having, you know, the people skills and, you know, I'll go back to my mom again. She said, you know, how did you learn to, you know, these skills to deal with such difficult people? Because everybody, you know, there's easy people, there's difficult people. And to be honest, I learned it from the horses. And, you know, when I look at a horse that's either defensive or scared or nervous or lacking confidence or overconfident, or, you know, you have certain approaches to that horse of how you're going to communicate and get through to them. And people are the same way. You know, if you have somebody that's defensive because they've had a bad experience or they've been misled, or, you know, they come into that conversation with that energy. And if you can identify what that energy is and where that comes from, it's so much easier to, you know, communicate with them the right way and, you know, make the most out of the conversation. Nobody gets their backs up. And at the end of the day, you know, like I say, we're all here for the horses. So
Love it. That's awesome. That's great. Oh man. Okay. So I'm quoting you here. Not a day goes by that I am not grateful for the experiences, life lessons, strength, resilience, patience, and the joy that the horses have given me. How do you deal with the flip side of that? The days that have tougher lessons that you have to learn and deal with?
Well, I guess all of those things are what gives me strength to deal with the tougher days. You know, and I think we're talking about, you know, loss, tragedy, you know, with there's a lot of heavy stuff with horses, livestock, people, life is not easy. It's difficult. There's a lot of tragedy, but there's a lot of joy. And I think, you know, when you can experience tragedy and also not be drowned by it, but still be able to see the joy, it gives it contrast, it gives it perspective. And I think, you know, the deeper hole that sorrow carves, you know, the more joy you can fill it with. Yep. I think is very true. And you know, we're faced, sometimes we lose babies. I mean, I don't have a hard time as much losing seniors or older horses that have had a good long life, and we know and have cherished them and respected them. It is very sad to lose babies. Very rarely. I mean, fortunately, gosh, it's in 20 years of breeding, touch wood, we've had a really great record you know, successful pregnancies and foalings. And I think because, you know, we're so on top of stuff and checking udders and checking back ends and everything to catch stuff very early, because most things can be treated. But, where was I going with that one?
Talking about on the other side of sorrow is the joy and how everything balances itself out. And
yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, we lost a foal last year. The foal was actually born breech, and we were able to get him out. I was able to get him out, and he had no vitals. So I resuscitated him, and his little heart fluttered and the chest started going, and it was a remarkable moment. And the little guy within 10 minutes had a great suckle reflex and was strong. But then we noticed that his hind legs were very contracted, likely because of malpositioning in utero. So he went to OVC at Guelph and had his leg splinted. And sadly there were complications with that. So we had 12 weeks of bandaging and stall rest and management. And so this little guy, I mean, he didn't know anything different, and he was the happiest foal within what he knew as life. And, you know, we started turnout around, I think he was about 10 weeks old, and then, you know, out with buddies. And then we got through the fall and we weaned him. And then we had our vet out to take a look at him. And, do some x-rays on his legs because he had a few things that that we were hopeful that we could help him with as far as angles and that. And we had noticed since we started feeding him his own ration and his own feed pail that his neck had an unusual conformation posture. And so we snapped an x-ray of his neck and he had a C1, C2 malformation. So the first vertebrae, you know, to the skull, first C1, C2. And it was so severe that the vets were speechless that he didn't have any neurological deficits at that point. Wow. And it, you know, it was such awful news after, you know, battling for his life, the, you know, backwards being born, the leg issues, all the bandaging, splinting and then to get past all of that and to find this deformity in his neck, that I didn't even know could be, was a thing, you know, it's very rare, of course, but when you see the numbers that we see, eventually you're going to see stuff like that. And, you know, the owners were amazing. They looked into taking him to Kentucky and having spinal surgery done. And it just wasn't right. It wasn't a good path for him. It wasn't kind. It was painful. The recovery, there was no guarantees. There was so many roadblocks. So we had to make the decision to let him go. And oh, it killed me, you know, and I thought, you know what, you could step aside and let the vets, you know, take care of everything, but I was there for him when he was born, and don't get emotional.
Oh, that's okay.
And, you know, I felt like I needed to be the one to hold him and make sure that he wasn't worried and wasn't stressed, and,
yeah,
you know, on his last day, too, so that was a tough day, and you know, a tough process. My staff, everybody, we were all so invested in this little guy, and he'd come so far, and to that be, for that to be the outcome was a really heavy, really heavy one.
Absolutely.
So, and I think, you know, being in that moment, letting yourself be sad, celebrating his life, you know, knowing that everything you did for him, was of your best of your ability, the kindest of your ability. And he lived the best life he could in those short 11 months, 10 months. That's what gives me some peace and some strength. And you know, everyone you learn and everyone, if you're ever faced with that situation again, you know, you draw from other experiences and you know, try to make the best choices. And yeah. So it's part of it. It's part of it. And like I say, the biggest thing, giving it the contrast, I think makes the highs higher, really. And makes you appreciate and being grateful for when everything is just right and healthy and happy. And
yeah. What a touching story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And yeah, that's, I mean, you know, as animal lovers, all of us who love them, it's, you know, I think one of the episodes I did was with a grief counselor on, you know, losing animals. And it's really, really hard because it's what gets us up in the morning. It's what, yeah, you know, it's what we do. And the loss is just overwhelming sometimes. And when you see their spirit and their fight, and like you said, he didn't know any better, right? So it's yeah, just amazing. Yeah. And I think that's really special that you recognize the importance of you being there for him. And it, yeah, it's like full circle. It was hard, but you knew you had to do it for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And really control my own emotions too, so that he wasn't worried or stressed or feeling, you know, oh, you know, what's wrong. And that is an art, I have to say.
Yep.
Right. You know, trying to, and that applies to a lot of things with managing horses, training and everything.
It's
keeping yourself, you know, in the right space.
Wow. Wow. Thank you, Claire.
Yep.
All right. So describe the atmosphere that lends itself to horses being their best selves. How much of that is your direct responsibility and how much of that falls to nature taking its course?
I think it's 100% our responsibility. I mean, given what we ask of them and you know, the type of life that they domesticated life they live, it is completely our responsibility to to fulfill those needs, you know, nutritionally, socially, exercise, healthcare. You know, it's always a balance, and I'm a big advocate of letting horses be horses, and letting them, you know, develop all the skills they need to have a good life. And you know, it's a dance with letting them be horses and keeping them safe, because they always like to, you know, horses.
They want to stress you out every once in a while.
Absolutely. They just like to, yeah. So, I believe that, I mean, we set up and we can recognize and do, you know, all of those things for them, and in observation, you know, directly from the horses, you know, you learn what they need, what they don't need. And over the years, you're just able to really fine tune that, so that they're, as I say, their best selves and living their best life within what we need from them as well. Yeah.
Have you ever had any air quotes special individuals that, in order to try to give them what they need, it's like a whole other like additive to your day, but you know that that's what that little guy or girl needs?
Yeah, you know, actually really interesting, we've had lots, but one comes to mind this year. She actually came to us last November, and she was a dressage horse, a middle-aged, quite an accomplished show horse, and she'd had some soundness issues. So the owner had decided, after a few years of working on soundness issues, that she was hoping to have a baby from her. She has a strong pedigree and great conformation, and you know, the soundness issues were just a injury thing, maintenance. So this horse hated turnout, hated other horses, hated the wind, hated the snow, hated the rain, hated the sun, hated the bugs. So, and it, her people loved her dearly and managed her accordingly to keep her safe, but in turn kind of created a bit of a monster that, you know, they decide, oh, if I run the fence, they'll bring me in. Oh, if I do this, they'll bring me in and they'll feed me. And, you know, they learn very quickly how to train their humans. And I think sometimes show horses, especially because they tend to be quite valuable and we, you know, you have to keep them in one piece, decisions are made to, you know, that may not be the best mentally or socially for the horses, but it's keeping them in one piece physically. So anyway, this mare came in and I think, you know, they tried to breed her this first season last year and they didn't have any luck, and a bunch of complications with the process. But then they just stopped and regrouped and called me and said, could she come and live there? And, you know, could you try breeding her next year? And so I said, okay, you know, let's do this. It'll be a process. And I remember sending the owner a video of this mare standing in her run-in shed, bundled up with her coat and her hood and everything, and it just sleeting down. And she was just hanging out. She wasn't walking the fence. She wasn't. So I had to call her bluff a little bit on stuff and say, look, you need to be a horse. You need to be okay. We're not going to rescue you. We'll give you everything you need. And, you know, you need to just breathe. You're okay.
That's true.
And in no time, this mare, you know, loved her turnout, got into her new routine, actually went out with another horse for turnout and got, you know, was very fond of him, and that went well. So, you know, knowing them socially and who personalities you can put together to benefit both and keep both safe, I think, I mean, that comes with experience too. But now this mare, so she transitioned from the training barn and learning to love turnout and learning how to be a horse again, to then living outside, being integrated with the brood mares, indoor first, and then outdoor. And I know, I think her owner had a harder time than the mayor did just trying to like adjust. I said, you know, honestly, here's the videos. She is just loving being a horse. She says, I know. But, and now the mayor does not want to come inside.
Oh my Lord.
She is like, nope, I'm fine. I've got my people. I'm happy. I got my food and my shelter. Don't bug me.
That's
awesome. And she has just transformed. So, and because of her now being a horse, being relaxed and having her needs filled, horsey needs filled instead of like show horse, like bottle wrap, she's pregnant. So it helped her reproductive system. I think, you know, there is an element of, you know, stress, cortisol, adrenaline that affects, you know, their fertility in a negative way. So if you can manage the mares and help them transition from show life to broodmare life the right way, you can be really, really successful with your breeding efforts. So
absolutely. Yeah. I know over the years watching you on social media and just hearing from, you know, mutual people that we know, that there were a number of mares that I massaged in their, you know, show jumping careers that ended up at your farm having babies. And it was just cool to see them be moms and how cute their kids were. So yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
That's really a really unique thing, actually, I find. And I think there's, you know, in transitioning show horses to being mamas, in a sense, in a natural sense, because we like the mares and foals to live together. We like the babies to socialize. We like the elements that the babies having aunties all brings, you know, they teach them manners and, whereas their own moms usually let them jump all over them and their butts. But a lot of these show horses have not been out with other horses in years and years and years, probably since they were babies, and they have no social skills. And most of them are actually, they deal with like a fear aggression. You know, they're like, if I scare you away, you'll leave me alone. And I think if you perceive that as just aggression, you would make different choices. And knowing that it's a fear aggression, which a lot of, that's where a lot of aggression comes from, is fear.
Yeah.
You know, you adjust accordingly and find them, you know, buddies or the right horse, the right personality to help bring them out of that mindset. And before you know it, they're in a happy herd of, you know, six or seven other broodmares. They have their little hierarchy, and even when they all have babies together, they're babysitting each other's kids. You go into the coverall and their big loafing area, and you know, there's six foals and one mama. And, nice. And, you know, this is a mare that's done like World Cup, you know, Grand Prix jumper stuff. And it's really neat to see when you really let them be horses, nurturing their needs and what they were used to as show horses, but also trying to nurture their natural horse.
I just love this conversation. This is like, I swear we could probably go an hour just on this topic alone. So I might have you back. If we can rearrange it again,
absolutely,
we should.
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
Yep.
All right. So one of the testimonials on your website credits your unique methods for getting outstanding results. How did you develop your style of training, and what is it that you think sets you apart from others?
Well, it's been a process from day one, from, you know, being interested when I was 15, 16 in the young horses and development, right through till now. I think, the first thing is not having an ego, checking your ego at the door, and, coming into any situation with an open mind and, you know, be willing to learn and evolve and change and be better. When I was a teenager, I learned, I guess, you know what, it starts even further back than that. I think I read The Horse Whisperer in grade six. And although my grade six teacher was like a little appalled because I think there's some steamy scenes in that book, but it kind of gave me some perspective and opened my eyes to, a different way of training than I had seen before. I mean, I'd just been at riding schools and learning, you know, traditional riding. So Monty Roberts, I mean, we're talking Ray Hunt and Tom Dorrance, and really, you know, they are kind of the grandfathers in some of this natural horsemanship that has evolved. So that was really interesting to me, the body language, understanding body language between the horses and between horse and human. And when I was 16, 17, I would play with Haley in the arena. And I remember being able to get her to do serpentines at a trot just with body language and me. It was almost like a dance, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was just putting in time and playing with my horse, and she was just teaching me so many things. And then I had a couple of mentors that they were very good at longlining. I mean, one of them had a British background, and the other one, I'm not sure his background, but it was fascinating and really fascinating to see how the horses, you know, worked with them and how they responded. So I actually was able to borrow a thoroughbred at the boarding barn I was at and learn how to longline on her and teach her to longline. So the natural horsemanship chef, the longlining, you know, traditional hunter jumper training that I've, you know, experienced in my life and different coaches and horses over the years. And then more recently, really, it's been fascinating actually learning a little bit more about their nervous system, you know, and when they're in their sympathetic or their parasympathetic states, and, you know, your fight or flight or rest and digest. And they can't learn when they're in fight or flight. They've got to be in you know, a learnable state of mind. So they've got to be in their parasympathetic. And learning about that and learning how to, like, it's really neat. We're now incorporating in my groundwork program exercises and that are teaching these horses to, you know, control their emotions, to make decisions. We're kind of rewiring their fight or flight when they're triggered. So, you know, it's basically with sight, sound, touch, and approach. And, you know, we stimulate one of these things, say it's just, you know, sight. So you just got a flag. And to give a little history on that, you know, people would be sacking out horses. So you've got a towel or whatever. And when the horse stops flinching, you stop. Well, we're taking that to another level that if you think about it, when you use a towel or something, you're sacking them out and they stop flinching. And you stop, I mean, they learn by the release of pressure. So they have just gone into a tolerate kind of place. They've gone into either a bit of a freeze or an acceptance, like they're accepting or ignoring, but they've just shut down a little bit and most people stop there. So you're actually teaching them to shut down, not to accept. But if you keep going with this towel or this flag, until as a question, I'm asking you a question, until the horse, you can see them kind of go through this process that they're like, oh, am I just supposed to stand here? What am I supposed to do? And they get a little bit uncomfortable and look around and then they'll usually stumble across the answer. The answer that I'm looking for is relaxation. So I want to see them drop their head. I want to see a big sigh. I want to see blinking, something, you know, ears soften a little, even a flexion towards me, a little softening in the body, and then you take the pressure away. So you've taught them with that release of pressure that if something's scary, you know, visually, the answer isn't to leave, it's to relax. So you can rewire them, like I say, on sight, sound, touch, and approach. To like self-soothe and how to get to this soft place, reset their parasympathetic or their nervous system. And then nothing that they come across will ever be too big that they can't be reasonable. Whereas if you're sacking out just to the point of them not tolerating, like just ignoring something, there will always be something bigger, right? So, you know, in that thought, it's kind of an irresponsible thing to do, you know, whereas if you teach them how to control their emotions and you get into that whole next level and they make choice, oh, I'm worried. Okay. I'm supposed to relax. Like, you basically are installing a relax button. That's magic. So, you know, long story short, between the, you know, the, some of the natural horsemanship, groundwork, liberty work, body language stuff. I mean, horses are naturally curious. So it's so great. You can, you know, working on drawing exercises and getting them into a learning mind state willingly, and then making a decision that they want to participate instead of saying you will participate. Mm-hmm. And then blending in the long lining and more traditional hunter jumper exercises and work and schooling. And then even, you know, incorporating the couple of years that I worked at that thoroughbred farm, and I mean, she didn't have a ring, didn't have an arena. We did everything on the Bruce Trail, down the roads, down the driveway. So the value in getting them out of the ring and letting them be horses, training on different terrain, you know, all of that basically has now landed at where we are now. And I mean, I wish I knew 10 years ago what I know now, because I feel like I can give the horses even more, and do even a better job. And in another 10 years, I hope it's even more and more in depth. Yeah. And it's, I think it's just being open to learning and being open to evolving and, you know, and as science and studies and different things reveal more information about horses, I think it's our responsibility to keep up and evolve and be better for the horses, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when you said they're but horses shutting down, internalizing, oh my goodness, so many of them do it. That's their safety zone. They're like, if I'm not here, they can't hurt me. So they just go internally. And then the whole idea of what you were describing there about them working through it, I mean, that's for on the people side of things in this era of self-awareness. That's what we call being mindful, right? Just helping the horses learn how to be mindful and recognize that they don't have to be triggered, and that they can do something, they can make a choice.
Yeah,
I love it.
It's so fascinating. And you know, I just have to add, I got a text this last week. We had a three-year-old here this summer that I put, you know, through all of this program, and she was just here to be started under saddle, but we start with all these exercises and groundwork, and I taught her owner, you know, and showed her what we were doing. Anyway, so she's gone home. She went home the end of September, and I've kept in touch because I'm always, you know, interested in how they transition home. And she said, oh, I have to tell you, I was hand walking this mare in a new area, and she was a little worried, a little anxious, and, you know, looking around. And then she put her head down, licked and chewed, and blew out and relaxed. And she's like, that's thanks to you. Like, and to hear a real life application and to see the owner recognize it and the horse use it away from here and without me being there, I was like, man, that's it. That's the magic.
Congratulations. Yeah. It feels good when you get that feedback, you know, you're on the right track. All right. So you say that the world is constantly evolving and our knowledge is deepening. How vital is it to continue learning both about horses and their care and about yourself so that you can continue your growth trajectory together?
Oh, it's imperative. I mean, it's just kind of like what we just said. And I think people that are open-minded, that can be mindful, that can check their ego and be open to change. And I mean, you're going to get so far in life. And if you're shut down and set in your ways and, you know, you learned how to do something once, and then that's gospel for the rest of time, I think that's very limiting and limited. You know, like I say, with scientific research and medical research, even some of the stuff about this, you know, their nervous systems and the information that's out there, I think, you know, it's when you're a professional or even just an owner, a horse lover, I think it's our responsibility to learn and grow and be open-minded and evolve. And, you know, just because you did something one way 10 years ago doesn't mean that that's the right way now with the knowledge we have now, you know?
Yeah.
So
absolutely. So what about your self-care? I mean, you give so much to the horses. How do you balance this out for yourself?
That's a good question. I think because the horses are, I get so much from them. I don't know, balance out. I mean, they are so fulfilling in itself. I don't know. I mean, it's a lifestyle. It's not a job.
It's a full commitment. So
it's yeah.
Yeah. Like, what do you take Claire days? Do you have activities outside the barn? Like, it's so hard, but it's so necessary. So how do you work through that? Yeah. I mean, you are still quite young in this journey you're on too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. Cause I feel like, gosh, I mean, I've come this far and I've been able to do this so young and I've still got so much time, but also, you know, you don't, and it's a funny place to be in mentally. But, I think, you know, I've structured the business, things change around here seasonally, you know? So we'll start in the spring. Breeding season is intense. We have 15 foals on the way for next year. We do all the foal watches, between my barn manager, myself, and my mom. We've got camera systems and, we're foaling out babies, rebreeding mares, picking up semen. Like, we're just it's go, go, go from pretty much April till end of July, August. And in the middle of that, we're doing hay as well. Cause we do about 150 acres of hay, just locally in some of our fields. And I love that. And I love the busyness and I love the intensity of it. And it's so fulfilling, but if you did that all the time, you would burn out. It would be so I really like when that comes to an end and then we move on to, you know, different things in the fall. Right now we're prepping for the Royal. We've got some cup horses that are going this year and some Canadian sport horses that we'll be showing. We look forward to that. It's been a break for a couple of years, but, we're excited to be back. And we do some like fence building and farm projects and other stuff in between everything else we have to do with horse care and training and management and everything. And then, you know, we have daylight savings and the days get shorter and all of a sudden I get my evenings back. So I'm, you know, fully exhausted by the end of breeding season and the fall. And then I have evenings back. So I feel like, I turn into a pumpkin in the dark. So I feel like I can get to other projects, stuff that I've been, you know, working on, video projects, working on my business, thinking about the future, making plans, working on the website, like that stuff. And then, you know, you get kind of tired of that. And then spring's coming around. So you get so excited that babies are coming again. So I think setting up the way we have, well, and pretty much December through till April, between projects and working on the business, you know, I'm also doing a lot of riding, and we take in some projects and difficult ones. We've had some really cool ones, but that's for another day we should chat about. It's just the great contrast between it all. So I never feel like I'm bored or burning out of any one specific thing. And I like that seasonal change. I'm into photography, and that's actually a bonus because I use a lot of that in the business for marketing, advertising. I love making sale videos and stuff. So although it's work, it doesn't feel like work. And I'm able to incorporate the hobby to benefit the business, which, you know, it's win-win. And my dogs, I have a collection of dogs and they all keep me sane or crazy or something. I don't know. I don't go away a lot. I'm actually going away next spring for a week or two, but we haven't because of COVID, obviously.
Right.
Done really much of any traveling.
That's awesome.
I feel like it's pretty balanced, and I am a homebody. I like, you know, being on the farm. I like taking care of the farm. I like being here for the animals and the people. And you know, it's a busy place. Sometimes we have upwards of 70 horses. So, you know, lots of staff and people coming and going, and you never really feel isolated or lonely. I actually really like when I'm really good home.
Yeah. Sounds like you're right in your element. That's perfect.
Yeah.
So what is the fine line to achieving that mental and physical balance in a horse's development that sees them evolve into a competitive championship level athlete? So when you've got that youngster, let's say those cup horses at this point in time, right? Like, where is that balance and heading them to their careers?
Yeah, well, it is definitely an art. I think, you know, it starts with understanding their needs. Like I say, whether it's, you know, their healthcare needs, their social needs, their exercise needs, you know, like a three-year-old horse, I mean, they need a full day turnout. They ideally need buddies. They have certain nutritional requirements and, health things to manage. They undergo so many changes and pressures. You're often dealing with ulcers or, things that need massage or chiropractic support because they're learning to carry riders for the first time or, you know, and their body's changing and growing. And so it's, you know, when you understand what all of those needs are and then, you know, the challenges and getting them to, you know, getting them to the Royal in one piece, basically letting them be horses. Cause I mean, you could wrap them in bubble wrap and, you know, they're not going to have a single blemish, but they're going to be a mental case. You know, they're, if you lock them up and don't let them out, but you let them out and then they whack themselves and they get a splint. So, you know, it's learning the techniques that you can keep them safe, you know, let them be a horse and reach their goals, support what they need, and get them where they're going. It is an art. And it takes a long time to get really good at it. And I think, you know, understand all the little details that, you know, even something down, this is interesting, you know, when, I mean, we're taking care of these horses, you know, to our absolute best ability and knowledge. And we're prepping them for, so, say the cup classes, for example, they're three, they're young, they're growing, their body's under stress. Their mind is under some stress. We keep it as stress-free as possible, but life is hard. So we see some that get mud fever that have never had mud fever and, you know, and then they get a little cold or a cough and they can't get rid of it. So there's a immune response. There's a, you know, when they're under that stress that we see some of this stuff come out. And I thought it's not interesting. So supporting their immune system and their GI system in that, and the microbiomes in their intestine and, all has a part, you know, their immune system and their ability to healthily, you know, get to the shows and get doing what they're doing in one piece. And there's a lot of layers to it.
There are a lot of layers, yeah. And you're doing such an amazing job at incorporating them and touching on all of them. Cause I don't know. Cause like, not, I mean, they see the big picture, which is this horse, and they see the goal, and there are so many aspects to what happens from A to B or A to Z that it's like anything can happen. So you've got to be able to adapt and you know, help them just be horses. Wow. Yeah.
And there's a lot of things you can do, you know, knowing and learning from other horses in previous years, that you can help out the next generation and help out owners and people, and as you learn and go, so that, you know, it's just more and better and better process and more and more streamlined for everybody's success.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So this next question, sorry, kind of touches on what we talked about a little bit just before, about the whole industry and looking after your whole self, the physical, mental, emotional. So that's tested on a daily basis, but you, like you said, you still enjoy your work. And you love it. And I loved the way you described being in the seasons. And that's kind of interesting. That's kind of given me a different outlook, because we all go from day to day and we talk about our goals and what we're completing in a day. But if we look at it in the way of seasons, right? It's kind of allows us to put more of a focus on maybe one thing that we want to do. And then when the next season rolls around, it allows for something a little bit more of an easy pivot kind of thing. So The concept of burnout, though, is a big one, especially in the horse world, and especially with dealing with some of the emotions and the heaviness of some of the things you can experience and dealing with people and everything else. How do you celebrate your successes? Are you able to take some time, you know, whether it be with you and your mom or your staff, or, you know, when you take some Claire time, like how do you reflect on what you're accomplishing and what you still want to do?
I think for me, it's really kind of celebrating it as you go. It's really not, it's about the journey. It's not about the destination. So, you know, and I feel like there's kind of two chapters in my horsey career here. I mean, I was 11 years in Loretto, and we've been nine years in Oro Medonte, north of Barrie now. And those 11 years at Loretto, my father was very sick, and there was a lot of pressure that I put on myself, and just really heavy stuff to deal with. And I also had this business, and I had 40 horses, and I was trying to sell and train and manage staff and make payroll and pay the feed guy. And like, it was an intense time, and I didn't take time for myself. I was rushing from thing to thing to thing. And, you know, I would say I did burn out. I ended up having to take a step back and sending a lot of clients home and just saying, my family needs me right now, and I need to take a break. So I feel really fortunate that I kind of went through that experience. And then, you know, mom and I moved up here after we lost my dad in 2012, we moved up here in 2013. And I feel like it was a fresh start with everything that I had learned in that previous decade, and, you know, rebuilding the business, rebuilding this facility, and knowing so much more about myself that I knew if I was, you know, not, I think it's being in tune with yourself, knowing when you're getting close or to, you know, or to a breaking point or getting a little bit off track, and catching it sooner than ignoring it. And then all of a sudden having, you know, a significant issue, problems, you know, it's so unfortunate in that respect. And, you know, I would even say here a few years ago, I was, it was pre-COVID, I was a little bit just kind of in a funk, and I thought, you know, am I done with this? Am I, you know, didn't really have the joy, didn't have the fulfillment. I really wasn't sure. I couldn't put my finger on what the problem was. And I was just, you know, going through the training horses and going through everything and, you know, doing my job, and people were happy, but I was just kind of numb, a little bit kind of neutral. And just when you get into that state, and you're not having that joy and fulfillment anymore in your days, you know, that's really hard to maintain for any length of time. So that's when, you know, as you burn out or you get, so I was starting to feel that way, and I didn't like it. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do something about it. And really thought about, you know, why did I get into horses in the first place? Thought back to the beginning, and that draw, the magic, you know, that's all I can explain. And why just figure out my why. And I had kind of gotten away from the round pen work and the body language work and stuff. I was just kind of going through the motions with other training techniques. So I actually got a round pen, and I set it up in my arena again. And I took some time with a bunch of horses that I had, you know, been working with, and they were going well. Everything was fine, but it was just, I was missing something. And I just thought, these horses are doing everything they need to do, but they're not connecting with me. They're not like, and then I thought to myself, it's not them not connecting with me. It's me not connecting with them. And I was just, you get so busy, you're in a rush, you're trying to make everybody happy, you're trying to get everything done, that you're not mindful, you're not in the moment, and you're just going through the motions. And before you know it, you've lost the joy and the fulfillment. So I slowed everything down and basically, you know, took tack off the horses and worked in the round pen and worked on some connection work and really got back to my roots in that. And that was the ticket to kind of resetting myself and lighting that fire with advancing even more learning And being able to integrate that with the horses I was already working and seeing them connect and participate and just get better and better and better. And so I think, you know, I don't divide work and life. Work is my life. It is my life, or life is my work, or I don't know. I mean, I feel like I can spend time with family if I want and friends and do what I need to do. But I also don't feel like this is a burden or, you know, it doesn't shut off at 5 o'clock. And a lot of the days I actually, I mean, I love what I do to the point that I almost feel guilty that I'm not working. I feel like I'm not working enough, which is kind of crazy. But, you know, then you spend, you know, 10 hours spreading manure and that's so it's, I think it's just, it's being mindful. It's being true to yourself. It's trying to, you know, having the confidence to stand up to people and clients and, like going back to being an advocate for the horses. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm here for the horses, not the people, to be honest. I mean, I love them all dearly, but that is my drive. These animals are my drive and making a better life for them is my drive. So, you know, not making sacrifices just to people please. And that's really hard to do when you're starting out and you're a young trainer and, you know, people want results. And if you don't get them, they'll go to the trainer down the street. And when you're trying to put food on the table, there's a lot of pressures that are not always healthy pressures. And I've been fortunate to, you know, feel like I, you know, have a lot of people respect what I'm doing and respect the business and, really value the information I have to share and give and our training methods and, rarely put pressure in any negative way. And if they do, I'm very open and very honest in saying, you know, this is how we do things. This is what I believe. And if this program isn't for you, which it may not be for everybody, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. You know, carry on. In a position that, and anytime I've actually had to do that, people backpedal really fast. So they do want to be here. They're used to, you know, wanting results and wanting them now. And this, it's a difficult time in the world because everybody's lacking patience and you cannot lack patience with training horses and caring for horses. You have no choice if you want to be successful and, you know, speaking up for them and being true to your values, being in the moment, cherishing the little things. That's what fuels me, brings me joy. And it avoids burnout, you know, and along with the season change, I think it's, just knowing yourself and setting up I'm so lucky to be able to set up this life and do this, in a way that fits my personality and my own needs and, so I can be awesome. My best for everybody else.
And I think, well, this whole conversation has been valuable. There's so much value in what you've shared here today. So I am so grateful for that. I think one of the main point that you said and what you just shared was, what's your why? If you are living your why as to why you are doing what you do, you're right. There shouldn't be, or there isn't as much conflict within yourself as to when you have to do things. I mean, my massage career of 24 years, you know, why do I do it? I do it because I too am an advocate for the horses. And I feel that, you know, I understand them and I'm the one person in their day that doesn't ask anything of them, right? Like there's an incredible connection and joy there for me. So at the end of a crazy long week, it's like, whew, but then, you know, Monday, Tuesday, I'm right back at it. So it's like, it's almost like living your life's purpose. You know, people say that there's so much question about that. Like, oh man, am I doing what's I'm supposed to be doing in life? And I can tell you probably like 25, 26 years ago, I could clearly state that I am living my life's purpose. And it certainly sounds like you are doing the same, my friend. That's so cool.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, that's an interesting thing because, and I think for horse people or people in the industry, myself anyway, you know, several years ago, when I was trying to figure out my why and doing this and, is this big enough? Is this fulfilling enough? Is this, you know, in the real world, you know, I'm just playing with ponies. And then, and it was hard to see, you know, it was a journey kind of through that to come full circle, to be like, you know, yes, there's a big world and there's all sorts of national disasters and all sorts of stuff going on and big things you could do. But I'm doing big things for, you know, these horses, their owners, everybody that, you know, if I could, like I say, if I can make their life better, then, you know, I've done my job. And I value it a whole lot more. It was just a process to really wrap your head around and be fulfilled in this career and it being more than enough. Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome. All right. So what is the vision for the future that you have for Braycrest Farm? And first, before you answer that, what does Braycrest mean? Does it have a meaning?
Yeah, Braycrest, actually. So I grew up 28 Braycrest Avenue in Etobicoke.
Okay.
My grandfather built the house we lived in, and who was sadly I never met, but there was photographs of them digging the foundation with horses. And it was amazing. My dad lived in that house his whole life till we moved to the first farm. He was 52. He'd never moved before. So when we moved to the Loretto farm, we were thinking of business names. When I decided I was, you know, going to make a go of this, I thought Braycrest, it's Braycrest Farm, Braycrest Stables. So we started with Braycrest Stables and that's the actual business name. And then moving up to Oro Medonte, well, because this is it's 100 acres and feels more like a farm. So we're using Braycrest Farm. And, you know, we just took a little bit of our old home to our new home.
Oh, that's so special. That's amazing. Awesome. So what's your future looking like?
Oh gosh. Well, I think, there's the two different, divisions with the business, the future of the breeding program. It's constantly evolving, in quality of mares and my own mares. I usually have between 5 and 8, and then all the resident client mares as well that we manage. And some of my mares now that are having babies are our third generation of my breeding program. So, it's really fulfilling. Yeah. Just to see how they've evolved, strengths, weaknesses, you know, physically, mentally, you know, where they're excelling in sport. And, you know, I always have, you know, as the industry evolves and the sport evolves and what we're breeding also constantly evolves. And, you look at sport horses 20 years ago versus 40 or versus 10, they're very different. Keeping up with that or trying to be ahead of it. And, so refining and, you know, I don't know about the size of it. I think, you know, the 15 brood mares is kind of nice. If we had more, we might need another 100 acres.
Exactly.
But, and then with the training, it's so great that both, you know, the training and the breeding at different times of year, they really support each other. And that's how the business has really flourished. But I want to keep going with, learning more about their nervous systems fascinating. I think we can, like I said, always learn and evolve and learn more and get better and be better. And I'm just excited for that. I really want to be able to reach more. I want a bigger reach than I can say one-on-one with a horse and an owner. So I've been thinking about and putting some time into looking at doing some live stream events and clinics. Not sure if we'll ever, you know, move ahead with like an online course or anything. I feel like I want to, you know, look outside the box a little bit and what we can, how we can offer support to owners, knowledge about horses that they may not know, reach a bigger audience, really just to do everything we can to help the horses and be advocates for them and get everybody to be better and improve and evolve, you know, I'd love to see, you know, it's owners is one thing, but even trainers, you know, trainers that are under pressure from, you know, owners wanting results, to perform and getting these horses to perform. And, you know, we all know the horse industry is very traditional. And, you know, even if you look at, like apparel, right? I mean, it was of all the sports in the world, it was probably one of the last to evolve to sport fabrics and safety gear and all of that stuff. So I think sometimes the mindsets are very set and traditional, you know, well, that worked 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And yeah, and it still can work now, but it can be better. It can be better. And I would just love to reach some other trainers that are, you know, willing to be open-minded about, you know, improving their process and just streamlining things and, I don't know, evolving with it all. And like I say, the big picture reaches more horses and can make a difference on a bigger scale.
Well, I feel like you've got big things in store for you. I think this is awesome. And I hope we get to meet in person one day. I think we could sit down and just have coffee and talk for a couple of hours.
Absolutely.
That would be awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you, Claire. So where can people find Braycrest Farm?
Well, we launched a new website this year. It's www.braycrestfarm.ca. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and I think all of our handles are through the website. If anybody wants to come out, you know, interested in the young horses or farm tours or anything, I love sharing this place with everybody, and you can reach out and contact me through email or the website, and
that'd be awesome. We'll put all of that information in the show notes and we'll post it up on social media when we do our posts.
Awesome.
That's awesome. All right, Claire, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.